to bring a box of pads or tampons for Chicago's Period Collective. We are about mobilizing people on the ground right now and making politics as accessible as possible while also not compromising on basic human rights.
And you're running for the seat to replace Jan Schakowsky, who's retiring. There are several other candidates running in that field right now. Why do you think that voters would be best choosing you as the candidate?
You know, Illinois does a lot of things right, and that's the reason they aren't dealing with, until very recently, people like Stephen Miller and Elon Musk on a daily basis. I have been. I am the only candidate in my race with a track record of fighting and winning against the far right. I am the most effective communicator in my race, and I am the only candidate in my race to have the majority of her money come from small dollar donations. We've raised over $1 million, and our average donation is just $32. We have over 7,000 volunteers, and that's not because I'm some force. It's because people want progressive policies. They want common sense policies. They want a center that recenters voters. And that's what we deserve from our leaders.
Kat Abu-Ghazaleh, I want to thank you for being with us. Progressive congressional candidate in Illinois 9th District, which includes Chicago. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
This is Bill McKibben coming at you on KBOO, Portland, Oregon.
Here goes nothing.
Tune in to KBOO for Drinking from Puddles, hosted by Brandon, every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. Don't say what you mean. That's Drinking for Puddles every other Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Yeah.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an early morning explosion at a food cart pod on 82nd damages 8 carts and 2 buildings. Jimmy Kimmel returns to his show tonight, but it won't be broadcast in Portland. And City Council considers loosening regulation on small street vendors. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 23rd, 2025. I'm Eric Leuschner. A propane tank exploded at the Southeast Portland Springwater Cart Park early this morning, with the sound reaching more than 40 blocks. Several carts at the cart pod on Southeast 82nd and Harney were destroyed. 8 were damaged, and 2 carts were a total loss, according to fire officials. 2 other nearby buildings were also damaged in the blast. No one was hurt. Fire officials say there was a leaking propane canister in one of the carts, and eventually that trapped gas reached an ignition source, exploding the cart. Eduardo Animas is the owner of a Salvadoran food cart that was damaged in the blast. He told Oregon Live, quote, "I'm just happy no one got hurt. I can fix it. I can take care of anything and talk to insurance, replace the doors, replace the window, cook more food. We will go on." Late-night host Jimmy Kimmel returns to the airwaves tonight after being suspended by ABC. But the Portland-area ABC affiliate, K2, won't be broadcasting it in its normal slot. On Monday, KBOO reported that K2's schedule had Kimmel in the 11:35 p.m. slot. He's now been removed. K2 and the Seattle station Como are both owned by Sinclair Broadcasting, as are many ABC local affiliates. Sinclair says they won't be showing Kimmel's show. On September 10th, Kimmel said, quote, "We hit some new lows over the weekend with the MAGA gang desperately trying to characterize this kid who murdered Charlie Kirk as anything other than one of them and doing everything they can to score political points from it," end quote. Portland City Council is considering loosening regulation on sidewalk vendors, hoping to spur more people to start small businesses. Councilor Mitch Green introduced the proposal at the Arts and Economy Committee meeting earlier today. As he began, someone in a hot dog costume approached him from behind the dais, handing him a hot dog.
Okay, colleagues, this is my item. There you go.
It's the green weed.
Where did you get this hot dog? Yeah, because we don't have a cart outside to get one from. Okay. Colleagues, I introduced an amendment titled Amend Sidewalk Vendors Code to Promote Free Enterprise. And, my motivation on this is to recognize that we are in a pretty dire strait financially in the city. And that what we are hearing is that there's not enough economic activity downtown, and that it's really too hard to do business in this town. And having been a person who's had some experience trying to open a sidewalk vending cart in this city, and running into a series of really high cost burdens, I had some intimacy with this code. And so the code itself is designed not to sort of take anything away in terms of our health and safety regulations, not to take anything away in terms of the city administrator's discretion on what an appropriate use of the public right of way is, not to take anything away about legal liability, but rather to lower the veto power of adjacent property owners for that new entrepreneur who wants to get their first start in business. It removes restrictive trade practices based upon the proximity of an existing business. It removes the restriction that it be restricted to only commercial-only zones. And also, there's another part of the code that says you can't have a sidewalk vending cart in any part of the central city, which is wild to me. Like any other city in the United States that has a vibrant downtown doesn't have that requirement. And then finally, the ordinance removes the design review requirements of this ordinance. So again, what remains is the requirement to comply with health regulations with the county. Nothing is changing there. The city administrator in this code makes final determination on what an appropriate place is for a vendor. And it retains the penalties for noncompliance and nuisance. So all that remains in place.
It wasn't put up for a vote today, but the committee did hear public testimony. Those in favor say more small vendors would help people get out to places like downtown and allow for more people to start their own small businesses. Those opposed worried about how nearby businesses would be impacted. Brick-and-mortar businesses are responsible for keeping up their adjacent sidewalks. Currently, property owners can reject a small vendor being next to them. Opponents also worried, what if someone were to set up an identical stand outside their existing business? Here are two of the testifiers.
Good morning, councilors. My name is Tyler Fellini. I'm a renter in District 3, and I'm the executive director of and a registered lobbyist for Portland Jobs with Justice. And I'm here to speak in support of the proposed change to our city code on street vending. Testifiers for the previous agenda item depicted a rather dystopian vision of Portland. And while that doesn't align with my experience in the city that I still love, I think the agenda item brought forth by Councilor Green offers a solution. I'm here for hot dog urbanism. We heard a lot about market conditions impacting our downtown and small businesses around the city. And this is all part of a larger economic recession. Certainly there are issues unique to Portland, but this downturn is being felt everywhere. In 2008, we were in the midst of another economic recession. And out of that, our world-renowned food cart scene was born. Today, with many neighborhoods still struggling to rebound from the double whammy of the pandemic and the ongoing economic downturn, we have the same opportunity. Street vendors bring people out, especially at night. They make our city livelier, safer, and more welcoming. For proof, just take a look at Seattle's Capitol Hill or LA's Koreatown neighborhoods or New York City. I have to ask, who does the current code really protect and who does it shut out? Requirements like getting permission from adjacent property owners or submitting redundant plans don't keep us safe, they're just barriers. And because so many vendors are immigrants, these rules too often function as coded racism. And let's be honest, if we take the current logic seriously, are we going to outlaw lemonade stands next? I'd also like to point out that the language under the current code's description of items for sale prohibits offensive odors, and similarly vague language led to the closure of Pho Gabo in Northeast Portland last year, and I would encourage this committee to amend that as well. Street vending is one of the most accessible paths to making a living, especially for immigrants and working class families. It also makes our neighborhoods come alive. Counselors, this is a common sense change. Cutting red tape will help small vendors thrive, support neighborhood revitalization, and make Portland stronger. I urge you to pass it. Thank you.
Hello again, councilors. Again, John Isaacs, Executive Vice President, Public Affairs, Portland Metro Chamber. I'm going to keep my testimony sort of casual today, and I want to thank Councilor Green for meeting with a group of our members yesterday, important stakeholders in this discussion that until yesterday had not had any engagement. And I was pleased to hear your commitment for more engagement. We're talking private property owners who manage a ton of storefront retail, Portland Trailblazers, Oregon and Restaurant Lodging Association. So we're talking restaurants, sports venues, our most important sports franchise. These are all stakeholders that express their willingness to be engaged. And just thank you for your commitment to do that, because they have not been engaged. I also just want to set the record straight on a few things about this ordinance. So first of all, this would definitely expand opportunity, and we support that. And we would like to keep working on this to achieve that goal. In certain parts of town, we could increase vitality, but this, we're talking about micro businesses. So this is not something that's going to generate tons of new revenue. In fact, most of these businesses won't pay any taxes to the city. And if it's not done correctly, this could cost the city revenue by further alienating storefront retail, which we were just talking about supporting. This, as drafted, the current ordinance would eliminate the 100-foot proximity limit for street vendors to similar businesses. And that's one component that we oppose, and we just ask to be restored. The other thing is the ordinance as written does not eliminate any costs. It doesn't eliminate any public regulations or requirements that the government requires. It only cuts out private property owners. We researched all of our peer cities, and Portland's code on this is not any different. It's not out of the market. In fact, the 100 feet is a little more lenient than most cities. There isn't a single city that allows street vendors to operate on private property. And in Portland, the private property includes the right-of-way, because we require property owners to maintain the adjacent right-of-way. So the discussion yesterday was primarily around liability and indemnification, that if you're going to say, hey, you're responsible for maintaining the sidewalk, property owner, you need to have some control over the retail activity that's happening on it. And so we asked for that balance to be struck. The last thing I'll mention is we did identify that there's a real opportunity for this in the short term with parks, and we are excited to work on that. Thank you, John.
Yeah.
Regulation and who enforces it was a big question. Councillor Jamie Dunphy expressed support for bringing informal businesses into legal compliance.
I think that public space activation is extremely important, and we also need to operate from a point of reality that these folks are here, and if we can do more to bring them into legal compliance, I think that that is a better use of our system, especially limited police resources. Additionally, city code currently requires a design review for compliant businesses in order to have a hot dog cart. So I think that the more we can move towards the reality of our current economy and regulate it in a way that creates safety, creates less opportunities for conflict between business owners and police. The best part of my day in a week or sometimes is when the lady with the tamales comes rolling through my neighborhood. I'm certain that the food she's making is going to be safe. I would also love it to know that she's not actively putting herself in harm's way or potential conflict with police, especially because I don't know her. I don't know her legal status, but she doesn't speak very good English. And with what's going on right now on immigration enforcement, I think we need to find routes to be able to legitimize these businesses. Lastly, I have been yelling about this for the entire time in office. Portland needs an active nightlife. We are the fourth largest music city in America, but there was a recent episode of CityCast Portland, which specifically extolled the fact that Portland does not have a late night food scene. We need more late night places for people to eat, and sometimes that looks less formal. The places I have seen hot dog vendors are outside of the Moda Center, at a corner of 122nd and Gleason, where the lady is selling cups of fruit or elotes. I think that we need to meet the economy where it is and recognize that this is actually a striking gap in our current system.
Insight from other councilors indicated they would support expanding access for vendors in parks, and could support it in the future if Councillor Green can get more buy-in from business interests. President Donald Trump recommends the FDA require physicians to say Tylenol can cause autism during pregnancy. Children's health coverage is being challenged by a shaky policy landscape, and late-night host Jimmy Kimmel is reinstated after being suspended. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
So taking Tylenol is not good. All right, I'll say it. It's not good. For this reason, they are strongly recommending that women limit Tylenol use during pregnancy unless medically necessary.
Despite a lack of conclusive proof, President Donald Trump is ordering the FDA to say using acetaminophen during pregnancy is associated with an increased risk of autism in children. Led by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the administration is pursuing controversial claims about what's causing growing autism rates. Many doctors argue it's due to better diagnoses. The administration also says a modified version of B9 can be used to treat autism and is advocating a delay in the hepatitis B vaccine, even though physicians say the early shot has made the disease non-existent for children. This comes as measles cases nationwide are at the highest rate since the disease was thought to be eliminated 25 years ago. Pennsylvania's childhood vaccination rates have fallen below the government's 95% target. Becky Ludwig with Pennsylvania Partnerships for Children says the decline started well before the pandemic but has sped up since. She says more parents are seeking religious and philosophical exemptions, while the medical exemptions allowed by state law have mostly been steady.
A medical exemption, which a physician would have to sign off saying that child or those children that they are not able to receive the vaccine. So that's been pretty steady as far as a small group of kids who have that medical exemption who cannot be vaccinated.
Booker says with federal guidance in flux, anyone with questions should talk to a trusted pediatrician. Last week, the CDC vaccine panel voted to no longer recommend the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine for children under four. Meanwhile, more children will likely be going uninsured, with states tightening Medicaid eligibility and checking it more often. Advocates say kids will mostly lose coverage due to paperwork issues, not changes to their status. Brianna Booker with the Children's Defense Fund Ohio cites efforts in the federal budget megabill to tighten the rules for adults.
We know that when we talk about Medicaid, anything that we do to adults happens to children too. So as we see HR 1 on a federal level cuts to Medicaid, that's going to impact our children exponentially.
The One Big Beautiful Bill Act is slated to cut federal spending on Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program by $1 trillion, in large part by pushing more than 10 million people from the programs over the next 9 years. Media reports say the Department of Justice ended an investigation into Border Czar Tom Homan even after he was videotaped in an FBI undercover sting taking money to help agents posing as businessmen get administration contracts. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt says Homan did nothing wrong, arguing this was part of the former Biden administration's weaponization of the federal government.
In the midst of a presidential campaign, you had FBI agents going undercover to try and entrap one of the president's top allies and supporters, someone who they knew very well would be taking a government position months later.
But according to reporting from several high-profile news organizations, the probe actually started after reports during the campaign of Homan asking for bribes in return for lucrative deals if Trump won in 2024. After almost a week's suspension, ABC is putting late-night talk show host Jimmy Kimmel back on the air. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 54 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 81. Today in history, in 1957, President Dwight Eisenhower federalizes the Arkansas National Guard to support the racial integration of Little Rock Central High School. The quote of the day is from Greek playwright Euripides, who said, quote, "There is, in the worst of fortune, the best of chances for a happy change." There are more than 100 abandoned uranium mines on the Navajo Nation. The Radiation Exposure Compensation Act was renewed earlier this summer, meaning people exposed to radiation are entitled to up to $100,000. But that set off another problem: scammers and opportunists trying to take advantage of people who could have a financial claim. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA, was recently renewed. It provides compensation for uranium miners and people exposed to Cold War-era nuclear testing in what could be a final round of applications. Allegations of predatory representation and solicitation are on the rise, targeting tribal communities, as KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports.
President Trump signed the RICA renewal on the 4th of July as part of his sweeping One Big Beautiful Bill Act.
By the 5th, I started getting these calls.
Immediately, Loretta Anderson noticed a problem. She's a tribal member from the Laguna Pueblo in New Mexico and says some attorneys and companies see RICA as an opportunity to cash in.
They're not only going door to door, but they're also having meetings almost every week.
This year marks 8 decades since the U.S. detonated its first atomic bomb at the Trinity test site in the New Mexico desert. Yet until now, no one in the land of enchantment could have ever filed a downwinder claim.
They mined them, made billions of dollars off the uranium, and when it was all said and done, they just left our people sick, suffering, and dying.
More than $2.6 billion has been already paid out for 42,000 claims since 1990. Members from 24 tribes account for at least 5,300 of those claims, most of which are linked to the Navajo Nation. Depending on their occupation or condition, claimants are eligible for up to $100,000, and that leads Anderson to worry about those very victims also falling prey to opportunistic third parties.
They're all coming out of the woodwork. Again, this angers me.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Piatarazio.
Renewable energy provides a sizable share of power in some rural Alaska communities, but these are tough times to seek federal funding for wind and solar. Denali Commission Programs Director Jocelyn Fenton testified recently to a U.S. Senate committee about the energy needs in rural Alaska. She emphasized fossil fuels.
Life in these villages depends on a fragile but vital infrastructure system. Small diesel powerhouses, bulk fuel tank farms, and water treatment systems.
President Trump has paused or defunded renewable energy projects across the country. His 2026 budget would reduce funding for the Office of Indian Energy while disallowing any of it for wind, solar, or battery projects. The hearing in the Senate Indian Affairs Committee was entitled Unleashing Indian Energy. That's a twist on President Trump's executive orders that call for unleashing American and Alaska's energy. But for participants in the hearing, the nuanced message is that renewables should be unleashed too. Senator Lisa Murkowski, who chairs the committee, says government programs should not favor one energy source over another.
The projects that we can get online quickest and quite honestly cheapest right now are wind and solar, and we do have several of these that are in that pause category along with some battery storage.
The top Democrat on the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii, said his information is that the Office of Indian Energy is sitting on about $30 million, nearly half of the funds Congress appropriated for the fiscal year. The year ends in a few weeks, though some funds can be held over from one budget cycle to the next. The acting head of the office, David Conrad, said he's not discriminating against renewables with that money, just waiting for word from higher-ups in the administration that he has approval to spend it. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Oregon has moved to extend more protections to the southern resident orca, which has dwindled to a population of just 73 animals whose habitat ranges from Washington State down to Monterey, California. Isabel Charlet reports.
Oregon's endangered southern resident orca population has gained new protections with the approval of 3 endangered species management plans. The Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission has approved the plans to reduce threats to this population of iconic black and white whales, whose habitat ranges from Monterey, California, north to the Puget Sound of Washington State. Colin Reynolds is with the nonprofit Defenders of Wildlife. He says the group started petitioning for a state-level endangerment listing 2 years ago.
Over decades, a lot of really devoted scientists, government agencies, and others have really looked into the species and identified what's affecting the species. And a lot of those effects originate on land. So it does really take that all of the above approach.
Southern resident orca feed almost exclusively on Chinook salmon, which are also endangered. Along with a loss of food, Reynolds says the whale's population is declining due to pollution and engine noise that interferes with their communication. The last count found just 73 of the species remain. The next step, says Reynolds, is for the Oregon legislature to fund and implement implement the recovery plans. Research continues to reveal the remarkable capacities of orcas, says Reynolds, from their complex communication, emotion, and memory to a new behavior documented just this year.
Scientists published research showing that southern residents groom each other using kelp that they modified, and that's the first time researchers have documented a marine mammal making tools.
The federal government introduced a recovery plan for orcas in 2008 and renewed the most recent five-year priority action plan in 2021. The southern resident orcas are known to have their own dialects and culture with distinctions between pods. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
A bill moving through Congress could remove federal protections for grizzly bears in Montana and other lower 48 states, handing management over to the states. Conservation experts warn the move appears to prioritize politics over science and puts the species' recovery at risk. Tramell Gomes has more on the story.
Legislation known as the Grizzly Bear State Management Act of 2025 has passed a key House committee in Congress, sparking alarm from wildlife advocates who say the move puts Montana's bear population at risk. The bill would delist grizzly bears and turn management over to states. Bradley Williams of the Sierra Club calls it part of a broader effort to manage species based on economic interests instead of scientific recovery goals. He says that's dangerous for an animal that plays a pivotal role in the ecosystem.
A lot of efforts through Congressional Review Act to delist species and overturn administrative decisions that are based on science, and then individual bills like this one. It's just been an overall effort to try and legislate individual species instead of focusing on the decisions that come from the agencies.
Williams argues at a time of rapid species decline due to climate change, following the best available science is more critical than ever. He points to a recent Biden administration decision to maintain protections for grizzly bears as evidence that the science doesn't support delisting. Supporters of the bill argue it would reduce regulatory red tape for industries like ranching and lodging. But Williams counters that the real issue is a chronic lack of funding to enforce the Endangered Species Act, which he calls the most effective conservation law in history.
If Congress wants to do something to help industry and to help ease the red tape and to try and make sure we're being a good steward of our environment and also making sure industry is thriving, then we need to fully fund the Endangered Species Act and appropriate that money instead of focusing on delisting individual species that are inconvenient.
He also pushes back on arguments that grizzly bears pose a significant threat to human safety, noting fatal attacks are extremely rare, and he cites the economic and cultural value of healthy grizzly populations, particularly for Montana's tourism industry and indigenous communities. This is Tramell Gomes for Big Sky Connection.
Voters in Colorado approved a program to reintroduce wolves to the state in 2020. There have been numerous failed attempts by the livestock industry to pause or end the program since then, but the state has remained committed to nurturing a healthy wolf population while helping ranchers reduce conflicts. Eric Galatas has the details.
Most of the 2.5 million cattle raised in Colorado will meet their end in a slaughterhouse and become hamburgers and steaks, but the state's powerful livestock industry still can't seem to stomach sharing a fraction of that meat with the region's one-time apex predator. A total of 19 cows have been lost to wolves since they were first introduced in 2023, according to Colorado Parks and Wildlife. Ryan Sedgley with the Endangered Species Coalition says more livestock are lost to weather and other predators.
This issue has been blown out of proportion. If you look at the actual data, it's really small compared to domestic dogs. Domestic dogs kill twice as many cattle as wolves do.
Industry-backed groups have filed two citizens' petitions to delay the release of new wolves, arguing that Parks and Wildlife hasn't completed its part of the bargain to end conflict and provide compensation, a claim rejected by officials. An amendment to pause the program was added in the emergency legislative session, but didn't make it into the final bill. A campaign to end the program recently failed to collect enough signatures to make the ballot, but organizers have promised to try again for the 2026 election. Sedgley says Colorado has been all in on supporting ranching communities, and many smaller operations have accepted the program passed by voters in 2020 and are changing practices to adapt. He notes the state's Wildlife Damage Fund was specifically created to help ranchers if livestock doesn't make it to market.
So if wolves do actually kill one of their livestock, they get paid full market value for it, as well as some other compensation methods that make Colorado's compensation program one of the most generous programs in the country.
Sedgley says state agencies and nonprofits are helping ranchers implement proven tactics for keeping wolves at bay. He adds Colorado's Born to be Wild license plates have raised more than $1 million to fund the use of range riders and other non-lethal ways to reduce conflicts. This is Eric Galatis for the Colorado News Connection.
The federal government is weakening regulatory protections against pollution, but the group Moms Clean Air Force is fighting back at a state and local level. Dr. Anthony Lisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Air pollution from power plants, vehicles, and other sources can worsen asthma and other health problems. So as the Trump administration reduces air pollution regulations, many clean air advocates are worried.
It's very scary because it's not abstract, right? Like my son has pretty severe respiratory issues.
Isabel Gonzalez-Whitaker is with the nonprofit Moms Clean Air Force, a group of parents working to protect kids from pollution and climate change. She says given federal rollbacks, the group is focusing on state and local advocacy.
This is a trying time, so we're looking for opportunities where we can find them to drive impact.
For example, they're pushing for state policies that limit air pollution, advocating for states to plug abandoned oil and gas wells that emit methane, and building support for more electric school buses. And they're encouraging parents to turn their concerns into action by writing letters and op-eds, submitting testimonies to lawmakers, or lobbying elected officials.
I think the more that we rally and the more that we provide voice to our discomfort and our disappointment, the less long, hopefully, that we have to live under circumstances that are super scary.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 23rd, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Edwin J. Vieira, Antonia Gonzalez, Tramel Gomes, Eric Galatis, and Dr. Anthony Lisowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River.